In the autumn of 2024, Ethan Rodley, Dan Sutherland and Damon Newhash set off in search of whitewater in one of the most remote and hard-to-access reaches of the country, Fiordland. The trio spent 100 days off the grid, paddling, hiking, filming and fishing to capture the adventure. By their own accounts, sea kayaking more than 1,000 kilometres, consuming 23 kilograms of flour, 31.4 kilograms of oats, 520 tea bags, 9 deer, heaps of fish, and the first known descents of 4 new whitewater runs. A novice filmmaker, Dan Sutherland, then took the footage collected and produced the film 100 Days in Fiordland. It's gone on to win Best New Zealand-Made Film at this year's Mountain Film Festival. Dan Sutherland is with us from, where are you, Dan?
Down in Queenstown.
Nice. Nice.
Down, how did you?
Yeah, great to have you with us. Great spot to be for people who love adventure. How did you guys all know each other? I understand that Damon and Ethan, they were Milford kayaking guides, weren't they? Just tell us how you got together and sort of put together this idea.
Yeah, so I actually went to school with Damon up in Nayland College in Nelson. He was a couple years younger than me. And then he went off to Polytech on the west coast there, and that's kind of how he met Ethan and got into whitewater kayaking and whatnot. And then, yeah, they worked together at Roscoe's. And then Damo kind of originally had the idea, and then he kind of bounced it off Ethan, and then I was kind of a later addition once they decided they actually want to pull the trigger on it and make it happen. And then, yeah, it all just kind of brewed from there.
And what was the idea, quote unquote?
Just to try and find the whitewater that it hasn't. We kind of figured there has to be whitewater down there. Milford Sound is one of the best kayaking destinations in the world, really. There's not a particularly large valley, and it has incredible whitewater and all of the little tributaries that come in there. And so we figured there has to be more down there. No one's really had a good crack at exploring it, just because it's so hard to access and then also get good flows with whitewater boats. So the idea was just to spend a winter down there trying to explore it.
What was involved in the planning? Because you need to explain perhaps to some folk how remote it is once you get in there, right?
Yeah. It's that was part of the challenge of planning. You can only plan so much, and we didn't know exactly what we were planning for. None of us had truly been like into kind of those some of those deeper fjords, and we had no idea what to expect, really. So it is, you've got Deep Cove and Doubtful Sound, which kind of, well, has road access, but you have to take a ferry to get there, and it's pretty primitive in there. But otherwise, those southern fjords, you're pretty isolated. It's a pretty big trip on a boat down to Bluff or up to Milford, really, which Milford isn't exactly the biggest civilization. Otherwise, everything's helicopters, and even that's not always the quickest. So you're pretty out there. So it made planning quite tricky.
100 days and working out what to take and what not to take and how to get your gear around, including the kayaks, the food, etc. You were pretty used to it, I imagine, being, you know, planning logistics. Was this one particularly complex?
Yeah, definitely. We couldn't pre-plan much in terms of how to move our gear. We were kind of having to be a bit cheeky and a little bit reliant on the people down there being so generous and willing to help. It was just too dangerous for us to tow our whitewater kayaks around the coastline with the sea kayaks. So the logistics of trying to get those moved from fjord to fjord with fishing boats was just a bit of a nightmare. So we had one first drop sorted with some food, and then that would move our whitewater boats to initially get them in there. And beyond that, we were winging it. We had no real plan. The plan was no plan.
Why go through winter? What was the logic of that? Was it a climate thing? Obviously, it's going to be pretty chilly, but was it more settled weather?
Yeah, so, well, part of it is just that's Ethan and Damo's off-season.
Downtime.
That's their downtime. They work the summer and then they get winter off. But also, the storms down there tend to be a bit more spaced out. You get bigger kind of calm periods, and then you get slightly more concentrated kind of storms that come through, which in theory sounded perfect for us, because that would give us the calm weather to move up the coast, and then once we're in there, it would hopefully give us a storm to bring the rivers up to get a higher flow to actually be paddleable. But it didn't exactly work like that.
There's a few things that didn't right. We'll get there. I mean, even needing the two kayaks, you need the sea kayaks to get in there, and then the whitewater kayaks. I think you did a bit of a deal with some boaties originally anyway to move some of the, was it the whitewater kayaks for you?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we are very fortunately new. Some guys in there, which was incredibly lucky, because that kind of organised our first drop. And so, yeah, they brought in the whitewater kayaks for us because it was just too hard to get them in any other way. So they got put on a crayfishing boat and then left on a beach, and then we just come and pick them up.
Just listening to you, this is kind of the vibe, isn't it? The relationship you guys had, and then the relationship with others as well. It can get pretty intense, can't it, the adventure sort of sports area? People can get really intense, but this comes across as being as much about three guys just, you know, having a great time, obviously doing something pretty challenging, but enjoying the moment. There's a lot of times where you seem to be just enjoying the moment, including when things go a bit wrong.
Yeah, well, I think that was a large part of, like, we're obviously really into our whitewater kayaking, and but we also just really wanted to check out the area, and it's just a cool place. So we were never too heart set on, like, having to get the rivers, and we weren't going to go pushing things to silly levels, really. We were just kind of, we were keen just to check out the whole area and enjoy the lifestyle of it and the kind of basic camping living and catch your food and all of that. It was kind of never just about the kayaking. So that kind of helped, I think, keeping it relaxed.
Just getting started, just getting in there. Tell us about the first sea kayaking journey, where you set off from, by the way, and then just what it took to get through.
Yeah, so we started on Lake Hiroko, and then we paddled down the Waihiriri, and then we kind of got to the coast, and the coastal conditions were suboptimal, was probably to say the least. And then we had to kind of punch out the river bar, or like the river mouth bar at the Waihiriri, and it was quite punchy surf. And so getting out of there, we kind of got hammered a little bit. It took a bit of pushing through, and admittedly, that was, other than a half day at high school, that was actually my first time sea kayaking, which, coming from a whitewater background, was kind of the only way I could get away with it. But yeah, then we had like 8 hours and just kind of paddling, and then we got this like 20 knot headwind, and it slowed the progress right down. And then we heard over the marine radio there was a gale warning, and it all kind of started going, had a lot of potential to go pretty pear-shaped. We got pretty lucky, had a lot of learnings, and yeah, it was quite a dicey time. It's a pretty exposed bit of coast down there. It's like not very forgiving.
11 hours all up, I think. It was dark before you could set up camp. And you were underway. Did you wonder after that first big nudge, did you wonder whether you'd signed up to the wrong gig?
Yeah, a little bit, for sure. Like, Damo and Ethan have just spent a whole summer sea kite guiding, and I'd just been working. I hadn't been in any kind of kayak for a month or so, and my body was just ruined. I was flattened. I was like, my legs were jelly getting out just because I hadn't used them. My arms were cooked. I was like, I had the full, that was probably one of the hardest physical days I've ever had. And then, I mean, those boys were sore too, for sure. There's no doubt about that, but at least they had a little bit of paddling condition. I was like, oh man, I don't think I can keep up with this. Fortunately, we had a few rest days there because we got trapped there with a storm. So that was fortunate. But
there's some free diving going on, and it's, oh no, not crayfish again. And let's talk a little bit more, because this is part of the story as well. Just the joy of being in the outdoors, catching your own kai. Here you are cooking it in the good old, put it inside the seaweed pouch for cooking it. Tell us a little bit more about that side of it. I mean, you really are connecting to the most primal sides of being human, aren't you, when you're catching your own food and you're outdoors and cooking over a pretty simple, Oh, there's some power on the go. You're speaking my language, you guys. So cooking over a pretty simple kind of grill and skillet. Did you get a bit tired of the old crayfish though in the end, or the blue cod? I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, it is awesome. It's like it makes you appreciate everything so much more. You've got like nothing comes easy. Even if you want a cup of tea, you've got to go and get your water. Well, get your firewood, which is usually wet down there, and then get your fire going, and then actually get it hot enough and get your fresh water and get everything going. It's like everything just takes so long, so it makes you appreciate what you do have a hell of a lot. Yeah, we didn't get a crazy amount of crayfish, but a lot of blue cod. We had, pretty much blue cod every day. At one point, we actually ran out of food entirely. I didn't put that in the film because, well, I guess I was hungrier, so I wasn't taking much footage. But we ran out of everything, and then we just had salt and blue cod, and I was like, oh, this is pretty average, but it's not too bad. Then we ran out of salt, and we're like, oh, this is actually quite grim. Like, saltless fish is not that great, as it turns out. But otherwise, we then got our first food drop, and then we're a bit less, we're a bit more frugal with just a bit more conservative, I should say, with how we were eating it. We got a bit excited in the first month, I think, and just kind of smashed all our food reserves. But yeah, it definitely, like when you have to go out fishing, even if it's raining and whatnot, and cooking over the fire, there's something pretty, pretty cool about it.
There was a fancy chocolate cake at one point I thought I saw. Again, there's some pretty impressive outdoor cooking going on here. Dan Sutherland is our guest. We're talking about the adventure that he and two mates, Ethan Rodley and Damon Nuhaj, set off on in 2024 in Fiordland, 100 days off the grid, doing the hard yards, paddling, hiking, filming and fishing in search of new whitewater sites. 19 minutes past 10 it is on 9 to noon. How did you go with the mozzies? We've been talking about what you were eating, but they're pretty famous in this part of the Motu. How did you go with them?
Yeah, you battle with them a little bit. I think that's another real bonus about being there in winter, is at least they disappear when it gets dark, the old sand flies. So you kind of get a little bit of peace at night, and then when you're moving during the day, you just try and keep moving. It seems to be when you stop that they find you pretty quick. So yeah, you battle with them. Everyone says you get used to them. I don't believe it. Not at all. Been there for 100 days, and then I've spent some more time down there since, and I'm not even a little bit used to them. They drive you nuts. It's, yeah.
There is remarkable footage here. You had a drone with you, right? Just tell me a little bit more about capturing the story that's become the film. As you mentioned, there were bits you weren't filming because you were too hungry or too wet or too peed off or whatever. But tell me a little bit more about, did you have the film in mind as you were going?
Yeah, it was, well, so Damo and Ethan never actually were intending on recording it at all. They're pretty, pretty casual folk. They were like, oh, maybe we'll get a GoPro each and record that. But they had no intentions of taking anything more than that. And then I assumed that's why they reached out to me, because I'd been doing a bit of it, but it turns out it wasn't. And so, yeah, I was pretty keen to try, have a go at making a film, and it seemed like a pretty perfect thing to do it. So yeah, we ended up spending a fair bit of coin on some extra camera gear. I already had a bit of it. And then, went through the whole kind of permit thing with Doc. And yeah, we just recorded everything we could. We didn't know exactly how it was going to play out, so I couldn't be filming to a script type thing. So we were just recording everything we could and everything that looked good, really. It was a fairly casual operation.
You got some amazing footage. We'll come to that in a moment. But let's talk about one of the central kind of goals, which is to find these new whitewater sites. How did you even know where you were looking? Just explain a little bit more.
Yeah, so a lot of, like, an insane amount of hours on topo maps and Google Earth, really. There's a certain gradient that if it's too flat, obviously it's the water's going too slow. If it's too steep, it's very unlikely that it's paddleable. So you're kind of looking for a certain gradient in there on the topo maps. And then, yeah, you just keep scrolling around looking for something that has a big enough catchment, so it should hold a good amount of water. And then we're kind of referencing it to Milford a lot because it's pretty unique down there, because you've got such steep fjords and then they like flatten out shortly. and then they're straight into the fjord. So we were kind of referencing to what looks similar to Milford in the rivers that we know are good. And then once we found something on the topo maps, we'd look at Google Earth, and you can't get a super great idea, but that would give us a rough idea. And then we kind of kept track of those, and then we'd just go looking up them. But then it turns out it wasn't incredibly useful because some of the better stuff we found wasn't on rivers that we found on the map. But it gave us a pretty good idea of what was around.
What are we talking here in terms of waterfalls? And, for a total amateur here, how do you decide whether you're going over the edge, basically? How do you know where you're going?
Yeah, it's always a bit more stressful when it's a first descent because you haven't had however many people go up
Jeepism.
before you to give you the all clear. But it's incredible how much you can read out of just how the water's reacting. If it's boiling up really quick in the bottom, so if you see the water coming up really fast, that tends to be a sign that it's shallow. Sometimes you actually see gravel coming up in the boils, and that kind of indicates it's shallow gravel. But you're looking to see the water coming up a wee distance out from the fall, so you can tell it's coming down and then back up and not too fast. And there's so many factors that go into it, but like the actual lip of it, the top edge of it, you're kind of just looking to see how the water's falling. And yeah, there's a lot of factors that just kind of come in with time, I guess, experience. But there's a lot we saw that were just no good to go. The vast majority,
And so you didn't
just
go,
not
clearly.
runnable.
Yeah.
Yeah, no,
And what
exactly.
sort of height were you getting to? What sort of altitude were you getting to?
The height of the drops
Yeah.
were or up the rivers.
Well, yeah, a bit of both actually. How deep in do you feel you went? How remote did we get?
We were kind of, I think some of the furthest we were really going was 5 or 6 Ks, was probably, maybe there was a couple that went a little bit further, 7 or 8 Ks. But most of the time, it just turns into, well, mountains at that point.
Yeah,
It's
exactly.
so steep down there that you can't actually get that far up the rivers until it just kind of turns into big cascading waterfalls for the most part.
And in terms of the
But yeah,
drops,
a
what do
lot
you
of
think
the,
the biggest drop was?
it was about 10 meters, so 30 foot, which is, it's obviously a big drop, but in terms of whitewater, it's not like ridiculously high. It's definitely high enough for things to start going wrong, for sure. We found some bigger drops, but we just couldn't line up the flows with them, and we weren't exactly chasing like tall drops. We just wanted like satisfying, like actually nice to run drops, which I think we got, which was pretty awesome.
Were there any moments where you thought we're in trouble here? Were there, what were some of the things that went wrong that really could have been trouble? Or was that first big sea kayak the main one?
I think the first sea kayak was definitely the main one. That had quite a lot of potential to go wrong. Just being, yeah, caught a little unprepared. There was also, Ethan got caught out on, we had this one drop that was just a bit funny, and the water kind of pushed out to the side quite quickly, and he got pushed up against the wall and was upside down for a bit of time, kind of stuck against the wall. He ended up then kind of swimming out of his boat and then kind of getting held against it a little bit, and then we got a rope down to him and pulled him out. And that was like, we train and set up safety for those kind of situations. So like it was a close call, but not at the same time. It went wrong, and then we solved it as it should, like as we kind of planned to. So that was definitely had the potential to go wrong, but fortunately, all went pretty smooth.
Some of the wildlife that you capture, for someone who, hasn't had much of a background in this, there's some great images. Some of it's kind of on a plate, if I can put it that way, because it's such a beautiful area. But there were the dolphins, little blue penguin. Where did you find the little blue penguin? Was it little
Yeah,
blue
was
or
that the,
no? I don't think
oh,
that's.
there's a Tawaki, the one in the cave there.
Yeah, I don't think that.
Yeah, well, there was a couple little blues in the water. I don't think I had any out of the water. So there was the Tawaki, the Fjordland crested
That's it.
in a cave in Bligh, and that was incredible. There was a fair bit of patience that went into that one. I ended up just being able to, there was a tree stump that had gotten pushed into the entrance of their cave, and I managed to just hide behind that for 3 hours or so, and then they'd kind of come and shower under this little waterfall that was flowing in. this tiny little trickle that just flowed into the entrance of their cave, and then I could just stay out of sight and just sat there and until I managed to get a few. But yeah, the wildlife down there was incredible. Just and we've got the time too, which helps. So a lot of patience, a lot of filming dolphins to try and get a lot of the shots aren't great. You're just sitting there looking at water waiting for one to jump. But yeah, no, it was pretty cool. Some falcons, and we actually had a humpback whale, but I just couldn't get a good shot of it. But yeah, wildlife down there is incredible.
Putting the film together for you. Well, we should say, actually, we need to acknowledge Damon passed away not long after you came back from this Fiordland adventure. And that must really, I mean, obviously there's a real impact on you guys and our condolences, but also it must really have made you think about what this whole thing was about, right? And how you tell the story.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it kind of, well, the initial plan was to, because we didn't quite get as much whitewater as we wanted, so the plan was to go back and film Milford, because that's what inspired the whole trip, and then kind of tie it back to that at the end of the film and do post-trip interviews. And then Ethan had gone home and he was due back down there in a week. So a week's time when Damo passed. So that kind of was a pretty massive curveball and obviously pretty rattling. So that kind of killed the motivation for staring at endless hours of, well, just him and the whole trip and everything. And I just didn't really know what I was making anymore, because that kind of disrupted the whole plan that I had in my, the idea that I had in my head. So yeah, it took a wee while to, like, kind of, I guess, come to terms with just staring at that much footage and just spending the time going through the footage to actually be able to come up with an idea to kind of get the inspiration for how to put the film together, after losing that initial idea with Damo, really. So yeah, it was pretty tough for sure.
It really does come across in the end as a beautiful story of mateship, and a beautiful story of just humans not only experiencing the beauty of the outdoors, the beauty of the wild, but each other's company in the wild. And it's kind of what it comes across as a tribute to all three of you for the drive to get out there and experience life like this. It's also absolutely beautiful videography. Was it, are you a humble man, or was it a talent you didn't realize you had quite to this extent?
Oh, I've got no idea. I've done a bit of like stuff. There's a few like whitewater brands overseas that I've done a bit for, and I'd never really put anything together. A couple little edits, like, and I guess everyone has, but then a couple since getting a bigger camera, most of it was just filming bits and bobs for giving to people. But yeah, I've got no idea. Not sure.
You came out much more hirsute men than you went in.
Yeah, we came out looking pretty
How quickly can a man grow a beard? And
rough.
how else do you think this experience sort of changed you or has impacted you?
Oh, I think in quite a few ways, to be honest. One thing we chatted about so much in there is just why. I mean, it's easy to say when you've got the money and time to be able to do something like that. But then in saying that, Damo and Ethan came into it with next to no money. And then we just was like, it's so hard to go and do these things unless you actually just commit to doing it. And then all of a sudden it's not actually that hard half the time. It's like, it's just committing to doing it, it seems to be the hardest part. And then if you just kind of go and get amongst it day to day, it's often not that bad, or maybe hour to hour. And that was like one thing that, and it still annoys me now after going through that, like why I'm not, should probably be doing more, like just go do more hard things. Not they even have to be hard, but things that seem hard, and just getting out and about more. I think that was probably the biggest takeaways. It seems like this big, dramatic, impossible thing to do, but actually, it's day to day, it's very achievable.
Sounds like I should be on a t-shirt there. Go do more hard things. I like it. I like it. Go start the brand. Thanks, Dan. Dan Sutherland,
No worries.
whose videography took the footage here from these three guys, these three mates on their 100-day adventure in Fiordland. The main focus was finding some new whitewater kayaking, but so much experienced along the way. The film's called 100 Days in Fiordland. It's won Best New Zealand Made Film at this year's Mountain Film Festival. More details on that in a link, I imagine, on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/9 to noon.